Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. You can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, Russia's Sputnik Radio, and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. We will begin with Radio Exterior de España, or Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes begins with a report on European Union leaders' meeting to discuss cuts in greenhouse gas emissions with a goal of carbon neutrality. The next day, there was a virtual meeting of the United Nations climate talks on the 5th anniversary of the Paris Agreement, where it was acknowledged that the environment is continuing to decline despite half-hearted plans to turn the tide. Secretary General Guterres called on all leaders to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries. He criticized countries for spending 50% of their COVID subsidies to aid fossil fuel production and consumption. Brexit, the withdrawal of the UK from the European Union, is facing a deadline of January 1st to create trade deals, and little has been resolved. Last week, Trump issued a proclamation recognizing Morocco over Western Sahara in exchange for the normalization of Morocco's ties with Israel. The United States also signed a $1 billion arms sale with Morocco. Spanish National Radio.
Last week saw European Union leaders busy in a series of end-of-year resolutions that included the unblocking of a 1.8 trillion euro financial package, a commitment to more ambitious cuts in CO2 emissions, and continued talks with Britain for a trade deal before the January 1st Brexit deadline. By Friday, the EU leaders also agreed to a commitment to more ambitious cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, raising the reductions to at least 55% over the 1999 levels by 2030. That's 15 points tougher than the existing 40% target. The EU says it wants to reach net zero emissions by 2050, a deadline scientists say the world must meet to avert the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. The European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, said of the accord,
"And today's agreement puts us on a clear path towards climate neutrality in 2050. It gives certainty to investors, to businesses, to public authorities, and to citizens."
European Council President Charles Michel chaired the talks and concluded, "We are launching a positive and intense diplomatic battle on the climate in order to inspire other countries around the world to support the ambition to reduce emissions. The at least 55% target is as good as final, but we'll need approval from the European Parliament, which supports a more ambitious 60% cut in emissions. The target is a compromise between wealthier, mostly Western and Nordic EU countries that want more ambitious action and Eastern states with coal-dependent power sectors and energy-intensive industries, which wanted conditions attached to the emissions cuts. Poland held out alone until dawn for a guarantee that promised funding from the EU carbon market for poorer countries would not be reduced. It also sought assurances that future national emissions-cutting targets set by Brussels for certain sectors would be based on gross domestic product, meaning that less prosperous states would be required to cut less. A majority of countries had opposed those demands on grounds that they would preempt detailed proposals that the EU's Executive Commission will make next year. The final deal gives a commitment to address imbalances in carbon market funding. The leaders agreed to meet again next year to tackle the question of the GDP-based emission targets, and in fact all the details on targets remain to be negotiated. For example, by 2030, to reach the targeted 55% reduction, an estimated 40% of all energy production in the EU will have to come from renewable sources. The consumption of coal will have to drop by 70% over 2015 levels, and gas and oil consumption must be reduced by 25 and 30%, respectively. Reconversions and the creation of a low-carbon infrastructure will require multi-million investments, including a key plan to make Europe's housing and other buildings energy efficient. The EU must also renegotiate its emissions trading system, by which the most polluting industries and factories are obliged to pay for each ton of carbon dioxide they emit. This system, in effect since 2005, has meant the closure of many coal-using plants, and now it will be rewritten to include maritime transport as a means of pushing that sector to abandon its dependence on fossil fuels. Despite the European Union's agreement on CO2 reductions and talk of a green transition, the next day at the United Nations virtual climate talks on Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for more on the anniversary of the Paris Accords.
5 years after Paris, we are still not going in the right direction. Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency? That is why today I call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached. If we don't change course, we may be headed for a catastrophic temperature rise of more than 3 degrees this century.
Since the Paris Accords in 2015, the world has seen the growing impact of climate change, from wildfires, droughts and flooding to collapsing ice sheets, and still governments invest in fossil fuels. Britain, which co-hosted the UN summit preceding the next talk scheduled for late 2021 in Glasgow, said it would stop direct government support for overseas fossil fuel projects. China in September announced that it would become carbon neutral by 2060 and unveiled plans for expanding wind and solar power, but made no commitment to winding down funding for new coal-fired factories. Japan and South Korea, which both pledged in October to reach net zero emissions by 2050, likewise made no commitments on coal finance, though they did pledge to submit more ambitious emissions targets under the Paris Accord. Guterres said the economic recovery packages made in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic were an opportunity to act to slow the course of global warming. However, the G20 wealthiest countries in the world had so far spent 50% more of the economic stimulus funds on sectors linked to fossil fuels than on renewable clean energy.
The recovery from COVID-19 presents an opportunity to set our economies and societies on a green path in line with the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. But that is not yet happening. So far, the members of the G20 are spending 50% more in their stimulus and rescue packages on sectors linked to fossil fuel production and consumption than on low-carbon energy. And this is unacceptable.
India, Germany, and France also made renewed pledges to commit to the Paris Accords. In 2016, Britons voted to leave the European Union and the world's largest trading bloc in a national referendum. Pro-Brexit politicians arguing that reaching a trade deal with the UK's former partners would be easy. The past months have proven them wrong. But then again, many observers, including the former spy and novelist John Le Carré, who died this past week at 89, recognised in Brexit a grand illusion.
What really scares me about nostalgia is that it's become a political weapon, that politicians are creating a nostalgia for an England that never existed and selling it really as something we could return to.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson insists that the UK and the European Union are sovereign equals, but with a population of under 67 million, Britain can hardly equal a European Union containing 447 million people. Regardless, as European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says,
one way or the other, in less than 3 weeks, it will be new beginnings for old friends.
As the January 1st deadline for Britain's departure from the European Union approaches, trade talks between the two former partners have been extended after multiple missed deadlines. On Sunday, Britain and the EU agreed to continue talks to try to break the deadlocks. In a tweet last week, the U.S. President Donald Trump issued a proclamation recognizing Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara, a former Spanish colony that since 1991 has been under a UN mandate awaiting a referendum on self-determination. The unilateral move seeks to legitimize Morocco's illegal annexation of Western Sahara in 1975 in exchange for the normalization of Morocco's ties with Israel. Shortly after Trump's proclamation, the U.S. signed a billion-dollar arms sale deal with the Kingdom of Morocco, which includes four super aerial drones and precision-guided weapons. The sparsely populated, phosphate-rich Western Sahara possesses a long coastline with coveted Atlantic fisheries and possible offshore oil reserves. The aims of the Trump administration in setting up quid pro quo relations with Arab and African countries in order to achieve Israeli supremacy in the region are tied to its fierce anti-Iranian stance. The Israeli and U.S. governments have been seeking alliances among the so-called Sunni moderate states against Iran, provoking still greater and more dangerous divisions within the Arab world. Palestinian former negotiator Hanan Ashrari explains,
The U.S. exploits the weakness or the avarice of other countries in order to bring them to normalize with Israel and in order to break Arab ranks, to destroy the Arab Peace Initiative, to violate successive Arab resolutions, and to place Israel in the heart of the region as a major economic, military, security power.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from her weekly program called Panorama on Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. On to Sputnik Radio. Excerpts from two of Afshin Ratansi's Going Underground interviews. The first is with ex-president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, about capitalism based on weapons sales, notably in the wars in the Middle East and Yemen. Then an excerpt from an interview with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad about the geopolitical dynamics of the Syrian war, which includes oil but is also a result of the end of the unipolar world that followed World War II. Sputnik Radio. First, here's ex-president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
You tweeted a picture from the UK-backed war on Yemen and said the starving child was because of the capitalist system. How does capitalism kill?
Yes, any system that stands against the interests of the people would fall into decay, even if they develop and grow for a short period. You should look at the names of the weapons manufacturers who are taking the lives of people in Yemen. And you'll notice that the nature of capitalism is war and destruction. We want a world without weapons, because weapons are designed to kill. Warfare cannot serve justice. Do they send weapons to produce food for the people in Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf? Or do they do it for slaughter? When arms sales are a lucrative business, then this is entwined with conflicts and war. Everybody knows part of the U.S. governing body are the owners of weapons factories. Without tension, without wars, those weapon factories will shut down. You could find a pretext and start a war among people and nations. The question is, what are the United States and Britain doing in the Persian Gulf region? Who allowed them to come into our region? Many problems in many parts of the world would be solved when the US and the UK and their like leave that region. They must allow people to decide for themselves. Yemeni people should be allowed to take their decision on their own. Let us close down weapons factories. Can we expect to stop wars when some economies have arms production as a major pillar of their economic growth and employment? Can we assume no war will happen when some countries' economic growth relies to a large extent on the production of bombs, atomic bombs, rockets, and warplanes, and a bulk of employment is dependent on arms industry? We hope one day we will see that arms industries turn into an industry that produces equipment to improve the quality of life.
Now, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
Was a big part of the war fossil fuel pipeline access to Europe from the Middle East that would cut Russian pipeline access to the European Union?
This is very realistic, but some say that they ask the president to open the Syria for a pipeline south-north, and he said no for the Russian. Actually, that didn't happen. This is not true. But there was a pipeline that's coming east-west from Iran through Iraq, Syria to the Mediterranean. If this one was a reason, it could be. If the war is about the oil as a factor, yes, this is likely to be. But this is not the only factor. Don't forget that there's war between United States and the rest of the world. You have now, we're talking about tectonic shifting and earthquakes, because the world order after World War II has been expired, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union and one polar world. It doesn't work anymore. So you have rising power like Russia and China and India and other countries. The United States doesn't accept any partner in leading the world, even UK, even France, even other big country. I wouldn't call them great power, because this is another meaning. They're not great anymore. They don't accept partners. That's why they are fighting now. So the war in Syria is a microcosm of the world war, let's say World War III, but without armament, through proxies. You have different factors. The oil is one factor of the oil, not because of the oil, I don't think. I don't believe, just because of this.
Those excerpts of interviews with Mohammed Ahmadinejad and Bashar al-Assad were by Afshin Ratansi from his program called Going Underground on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. The U.S. is having convoys of oil tankers transporting Syrian oil to Iraq with military escorts. At the 18th summit of the Bolivarian Alliance for the People, agreements were reached on dealing with COVID and supporting each other from the threats and sanctions of the U.S. government. Israeli protests against Prime Minister Netanyahu have continued for 25 weeks. Radio Havana, Cuba.
A convoy of dozens of U.S. tankers has left Syria's northeastern province of Hasaka for neighboring Iraq, laden with Syrian crude oil, as Washington continues looting the country's energy resources. Syria's official news agency, SANA, Sana, citing local sources in the village of Al-Suwaidia, reported that a convoy of 85 military vehicles and tankers left Syria through Al-Walid border crossing on Sunday, heading towards Iraq. The sources added that 16 armored vehicles of the U.S. military escorted the convoy until it reached the border crossing. The U.S. first confirmed its looting of Syrian oil during a Senate hearing in an exchange between South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. It was on July the 30th, during his testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that Pompeo confirmed that an American oil company was to begin working in northeastern Syria in areas controlled by terrorists from the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF. The Syrian government has strongly condemned the agreement, saying that the deal was struck to plunder the country's natural resources, including oil and gas, under the sponsorship and support of the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump.
Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel recalled for solidarity and regional cooperation during the 18th summit of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of America, People's Trade Agreement, held virtually this Monday. In the meeting, the president reiterated the island's willingness to expand collaboration in public health with the members of the alliance through epidemiological advice and exchange of experiences in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. President Díaz-Canel ratified the firm support to the brotherly Nicaraguan people, who under the leadership of the Sandinista National Liberation Front and the leadership of Commander Daniel Ortega Saavedra have worthily defended the remarkable achievements made in recent years despite the threats, sanctions, and interfering actions of the United States government. He also expressed joy at the reincorporation of the plurinational state of Bolivia into this alliance. Once again, the heroic Bolivian people have made history by resuming the path of building a more just, inclusive, and humanist society, he said. As another essential turning point for the Bloc peoples, the president considered the indisputable victory of the Great Patriotic Poll in the legislative elections held on December the 6th in Venezuela, which reflects the widespread support for the Bolivarian and Chavista revolutionary process led by comrade Nicolas Maduro Moros.
In the 25th consecutive week of protests held in Israel against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a group called Crime Minister has vowed to lay siege to the Premier's residence until he relinquishes power. The protesters rallied across the occupied territories on Saturday evening, demonstrating against Netanyahu over his indictment on graft charges and his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. 2,000 protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, and several hundred attended rallies in the coastal city of Caesarea, where Netanyahu's private home is located. Crime Minister decided to lay siege to Netanyahu's residence after 27 demonstrators were arrested in last week's demonstration that attempted to block the entrances and exits to the home. According to Israeli media, the organization said in a statement, "We'll shut him in until he goes."
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website has been working well this week at radiohc.cu. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, or could make a donation for production cost of this listener-funded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support my efforts. I am grateful for donations from a listener of WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, and from radio station CKUW in Winnipeg. Many, many thanks. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. A series of news briefs on Bitcoin, Belarus, a new arms race with Russia and Sudan. Then global COVID reports and Reporters Without Borders. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Bitcoin has risen to an all-time high of $20,000. The value of the virtual currency has rocketed since March when it was worth just $5,000. Analysts say high-risk funds are turning to more exotic investments like Bitcoin to make a profit. Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya has received the European Parliament's top human rights prize on behalf of her movement. The Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought is awarded yearly to an individual or group for an outstanding contribution to democracy and human rights.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused the United States of starting a new arms race in his annual news conference facing hundreds of journalists. Mr. Putin said Washington's refusal to extend the New START treaty, limiting nuclear armaments, had forced Russia to respond by developing new hypersonic weapons.
The U.S. has removed Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, opening the African nation up to financial assistance that could help its struggling economy. Washington placed tough sanctions on Sudan in 1993, claiming that President Omar al-Bashir was harboring militant groups, including al-Qaeda.
Dozens of police officers have been injured in clashes with anti-lockdown protesters in Ukraine. Demonstrators gathered in Kiev to rally against recently announced coronavirus restrictions. Non-essential business, schools and gyms will be shut from the 8th of January onwards in an effort to slow the spread of the virus. Countries across Europe are tightening coronavirus restrictions after a surge in cases. The British capital London and parts of southern England will go into a stricter lockdown from midnight on Tuesday night. The Netherlands and the Czech Republic are also implementing stricter measures. The drug maker Moderna says hackers accessed documents related to its COVID-19 vaccine candidate during a cyber attack on Europe's medicines regulator. Israel is starting the second phase for a vaccine that, if successful, could be rolled out next summer. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has confirmed the country's first known case of the coronavirus in a wild animal, a mink.
A study in Spain has found that 1 in 10 people has been infected with the coronavirus. A national survey examining the presence of antibodies showed that almost 5 million Spaniards have contracted the virus so far. The World Health Organization says that it is in talks with Pfizer and Moderna about including their coronavirus vaccines for poor countries at affordable prices. The WHO-backed COVAX initiative aims to ensure equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines around the world. And top U.S. public health expert Dr. Anthony Fauci has called for President-elect Joe Biden to be vaccinated as soon as possible in the interest of national security. He said that Vice President-elect Kamala Harris should also get the vaccine.
The U.S. drugs regulator has announced that its analysis of the Moderna vaccine indicates that it is safe and 94% effective, meaning emergency approval could be granted in days and the drug rolled out next week. South Korean officials say the capital, Seoul, has only 3 intensive care beds left in a city with a population of nearly 26 million. The country has reported a record surge in cases over recent days. And scientists from the World Health Organization are planning to visit the Chinese city of Wuhan, where the coronavirus was first reported. They want to find out how it jumped species from animals to humans.
The U.S. has registered more than 3,700 COVID deaths within 24 hours, another grim record. That's according to numbers compiled by Johns Hopkins University. Twitter has announced it will remove tweets containing misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines. Facebook and YouTube have already announced similar measures. And a health worker in the U.S. has suffered a severe allergic reaction after getting the BioNTech-Pfizer vaccine. Unlike similar cases in the U.K., she had no history of serious allergies. Doctors say they are prepared to treat rare reactions, which can happen during vaccine rollouts.
Reporters Without Borders has released its annual report on journalists who have been detained, are missing, or held hostage worldwide. 387 journalists are in detention globally, just 2 fewer than last year. The biggest jailers are China, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. But the study also cited an unprecedented crackdown in Belarus, which has seen months of unrest since its disputed election. The report noted a pandemic effect where countries used the coronavirus crisis to increase control of the media.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There is a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening globally at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.